Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. And you know, I always love finding that connection between music and politics. It's something I love, especially as of recent. And we got it this week, Slayer. Slayer, on the band's Instagram account, you may have heard about this. They posted a picture of them with Donald Trump. Turns out it was the lead singer that posted it. And they were getting some flack for that. And the lead singer was calling the haters snowflakes. Which is such a, I'm so tired of that insult. And you know, I've gotten it from a lot of different people. I've gotten it from folks on the right. I've also gotten it from a lot of really staunch Hillary supporters, which I guess are kind of still folks on the right. Depends on the person. It depends on the person. I know we need some unity here, so I'm trying to be fair. But anyway. I'm really tired of that, and so here's the thing, though. Here's where it got a little weird. At one point, he made a joke about Mike Pence saying that he likes to turn fruits into vegetables. That, of course, refers to the electro conversion, quote, therapy for gay people, which Mike Pence has said some alarming things in regards to. Hinting that he's not opposed to it, basically. And, you know, first of all, that term is very, I mean, that was something that I know that we used to say in grade school. And of course, it wasn't coming from a homophobic place. It was coming from a place of kids that didn't know any better. It was kids that weren't educated yet, you know. And that's the last time you really heard that type of terminology. And I guess it makes sense that Slayer would use that because that's the last time they were relevant as far. And I get it, they're legends. I'm just saying their prime's past. And so the band has come out about this and they said, look, this does not represent us as the band. This was our lead singer that was doing all this. The lead singer posted this. The lead singer made that homophobic joke. We don't get involved in this stuff. And you guys know how I feel about the whole, you can't stand for nothing. You got to stand for something. This whole, like, we're going to be neutral. We're not going to stand for anything. Look, rock and roll is in and of itself political. I gave this spiel before. I'm not going to give it again. But rock and roll is in and of itself political. If your lead singer's a Trump supporter, just own it. And if your entire band's a Trump supporter, own that too. If you guys are divided on that, well, then you need to make up some clear boundaries about what you actually stand for. I'm not saying that individual members of a band can't have different political opinions. I'm sure they can. I personally would not be in a band with somebody that was on the opposite side of the fence of me because there would be some creative differences we wouldn't be able to get over because any music I would make would have a political edge. And if you're against that ideology, well, then I guess we don't, I don't know how we can create properly. But that's just me. Not every band would have that hurdle. So, but you gotta stand for something. We stand in freedom of expression. We stand for trying to unify. Hey, you know, like this guy, we were really big Hillary, this guy's Trump, or we were really big Jill Stein, this guy's Trump, whatever it may be. But we try to find common ground, and we don't give individual candidate support one way or the other as a band. We don't think that's the way to go about it, but we stand for something. Can't just stand for nothing. And a lot of my friends in the metal community, because I have a lot of friends that are metalheads. I've always been a punk guy, you know, I think the punk and metal, they're cousins that get along pretty well. That's what I think. Some of my best friends in the world are metalheads. And a lot of them have spoken out about this, saying that Slayer was wrong here, that this was not cool, that this was not in any way okay. And, you know, I think a lot of times getting on the punk v metal thing, not that it's necessarily like a rival per se, but there's a little bit of, you know, other sides of the fence going on. I think a lot of metalheads are punk rockers that haven't discovered punk rock yet. You know, when I think back to my preteen years, a lot of the metalheads, they just hadn't found punk yet. And then when they found punk, they were like, whoa, yeah, this is for us. I'm not saying, I mean, music, of course, is subjective. But, you know, sometimes I can't help but see my metalhead friends and wonder, have you discovered punk rock yet? Now, I know that some people just prefer it, and there's nothing wrong with that. I prefer punk. A lot of my friends prefer metal. We're just different. Nothing wrong. You know, and I don't want this to, oh, Ron, you know, when I was talking about the Bruce Springsteen cover band, how they should have dropped out of the inauguration sooner and they should have known better, and when I was talking about how Three Doors Down is awful because they don't stand for anything, which I stand by, and I gave my reasons for it, you know, a lot of people, I got some flack that I'm being a purist, I'm trying to be some moral superior here, and I'm really not. It's not some huge holier-than-thou statement to say, look, you got to stand for something. You can't just be like, oh, there's going to be a lot of people here. Sure, we'll play. Well, it could be a KKK rally or a Trump inauguration. And guess what? Those lines are blurred. So no, you can't. Oh, there's people here. We'll play. You got to stand for something. That's not some huge big statement. That's not some huge stance. That's just expecting a minimum amount of integrity from people in the public spotlight. I don't think that's that big of a deal. Today's guest, since we're on this topic, is Joe Sib. Joe Sib runs Side One Dummy Records. He is a musician. He played in the band Wax. He is the voice on the Sweater Song by Weezer. We don't talk about that in the interview. He tells a story about it on stage. You know, he's doing stand-up now. He does a story about it on stage. But, you know, the Sweater Song by Weezer, there's that conversation going on. That's his voice. And you hear it. You can hear it in the interview. You'll hear it, and you'll be like, oh, yeah, that's totally him. We do not talk about it in the interview. I didn't bring it up because I know he talks about it a lot. So I didn't want to focus on that. But it is a fun discussion. You know, speaking of punk v. metal, here's a dude definitely on the punk side of the coin here. And you know what? Maybe I need to get some more metal people on the show. You know what? Maybe I'll get our old contributor Rob Haynes from the Nashville days. Maybe I should get him to weigh in on the Slayer thing. I'd be curious to know what he has to say. Haven't had him on in a while. So maybe we'll do something. But, you know, I'm just not a big metal guy myself. It just wasn't quite my cup of tea, so I don't have many metal guests on this show. But I'm certainly not opposed to it either. Going to jump right in this week. IndieBohemians@gmail.com. Drop me a line. RonPlacone.com. What do you think about the Slayer thing? What do you think about the world at large? What funds are going to get cut next? We live in a country where we want to strip the arts to build a wall across a border that did nothing to us. Sleep tight.
Here's the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians. A new species of primate has been discovered in Myanmar. Scientists have dubbed it Skywalker. The authors of a recent paper published in the American Journal of Primatology were able to differentiate the Skywalkers from other Hulak gibbon species based on both appearance and genetic sequencing. Skywalker Hulak gibbons are defined by their characteristic eyebrows, their distinct teeth shapes, and the color of their eye rings, beard, and foreskin fur. So do we say, may the foreskin be with you, or use the foreskin? That's the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians.
Ron Placone, you are listening to Indie Bohemians. I am joined today by Joe Sib, a record label extraordinaire, musician, comedian, jack of many trades, good father. We were talking about that. This guy, yeah, you're doing it all, man.
Feels like it.
Thanks for hanging out.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ron, I'm psyched we could finally sit down. I didn't realize we were going to literally do the interview in my car.
I know.
Sounds good in here, though, right?
It sounds good. The acoustics are great, and yeah, like I said, I'm gonna have to be part of the team now because yeah. I think I want this to be my new studio.
There you go. We tried to maybe do it by the cafe we were at, but it was way too loud. So I'm psyched right
here. Too loud. Too many people just wanting to be normal human beings.
Yeah, not listen to us.
And they're
ramble.
Like, look, everybody in Los Angeles is peddling content. We just want a cup of coffee, yeah. And you guys are like, we're creating something.
Yeah.
We didn't want to be those guys.
No.
So let's where did you grow up? You're a California native, right?
Yeah, I mean I'm actually not a California native. My whole background is I grew up I was born in back east. So my parents made me they made me in Philadelphia.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, because my dad was getting his master's degree out there. And what ended up happening was they met out on the East Coast. My dad, Italian Catholic, my mom, Irish Catholic. They met on I guess back then you would go on a cruise for like spring break. Like, we're going down to the Bermudas. That's what they would do. So they went out and they both met each other on this cruise ship and they hung out and they decided like, hey, let's get married. And at that point, my dad was studying to be a teacher. And my mom at that point was getting ready to move to California. And they decided to get married. They got married out there. And then my dad stayed out there to get, I believe it was his PhD. And he was working on that, and that's kind of where I came into the picture out there. But then as soon as I was born, it just coincided with them making their move to California. So I always kid around that I look like I'm from the East Coast, you know, and people think I'm from the East Coast, but I'm, you know, I was only there for like 2 weeks. And then they moved literally to Northern California, and that's where I stayed all the way until I was 22 years old.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I didn't realize you weren't born there. So, yeah. when did punk rock creep into your life?
You know, what happened to me was my parents got separated when I was in fifth grade, and it was the '80s, and my mom stayed in Santa Cruz and my dad moved about 30, 40 miles, away to this, to a city called San Jose. So I was living on the coast. I was living in Santa Cruz right on the, you know, right. It's a beach town. And I was raised there when my parents were together, kind of out in the woods, like not even kind of, like we literally lived out in the Santa Cruz mountains, which is just all redwood trees. And their whole idea when they were married was they were gonna stable horses, they were really ahead of their time in the sense of they wanted to have like a self-sustaining lifestyle. Like they had a well for water, they had the chickens, they had, you know, they were doing everything. But at the same time, my dad was still working teaching, so my mom was kind of running this farm / ranch, and that was really the demise of their relationship, because my mom was, you know, holding it down there and my dad was still trying to do, he was doing both things.
What do you teach?
He was an English professor at that point. He started out as a linguist, which is super which is super funny, because the way I talk, you know, in my vocabulary, he used to always say to me, like, you're the only person I know that uses the F word to describe, like, so many different emotions. I would love just to do a study on you and the words you choose, you know? But what ended up happening was, for me, when my parents got separated, like I said, my mom moved into the suburbs of Santa Cruz, and my dad moved to San Jose to continue teaching. And right around, like, for me, I was never into music. You know, I had only grown up into what my parents were into. So when my mom and dad got separated, right around seventh grade, I would go to visit my dad on the weekends. And, you know, we would do what divorced dads do and sons, you know, play basketball, play football, and, you know, all of that. But right around that time period, I was always really into skateboarding. Like, skateboarding was... That was really my main sport as a kid growing up, because I was okay at the other sports, but skateboarding really lended itself to, you know, it was me and I didn't have a coach and I kind of could take it at the pace I wanted to. So I really, through the 70s, was really, really into skateboarding. And when I went to visit my dad, there was a skateboard park right by his house, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. Cause in Santa Cruz, you know, people skateboarded, but you know, we didn't have parks yet. We had a couple, we had Derby Skate Park and there had been Soquel Skate Park, but that was all, you know, a public park and also before my time. So now all of a sudden, you know, I'm in seventh grade and there's a skateboard park and my dad was like, hey, let's check it out. And I was like, all right. So I went there and I remember I went there and that was just a game changer for me, because at that moment I'd never been around that many kids skateboarding and I'd never been around, like just like a cool element of people. Like I was full on just kid with glasses, bowl haircut. Like I didn't know anything about music. I'd only listen to what my parents listened to. Yeah. And what they listened, their record collection was awesome. You know, it had everything from the Beatles to you know, Frank Sinatra to Jim Croce, you know, all these artists that you know they were into at that point. So then all of a sudden I go to skateboard park and it was a double whammy because I just was so blown away with skateboarding and where it was at. I'd never seen anything like that. But then also the music they were playing at skateboard park, that was the first time ever I remember I heard like the Buzzcocks and 999. And I'd heard, you know, obviously I knew about the Ramones and I'd heard about the Sex Pistols, but it was like ground zero at the park for all of that music. So
were they playing DC hardcore at that point?
No, none of that. That didn't come until later. I mean, okay. You know, because it's funny because actually, you know, this is, so I'm a part of like, you know, there's first generation, which is, you know, the Pistols and all that. And then that spawns into the second generation and then, in which is, you know, Black Flag and Circle Jerks and all that. And then you kind of have the third generation, which, you know, I always feels like, you know, the that's where you get the 7 Seconds and the Minor Threat and all of that and the Youth Brigade, you know, all that stuff. And it's funny because years ago, I'm totally going on a tangent here, when I was on Indie 103.1 here in Los Angeles, you know, Henry Rollins was on there and I was on there and our shows were back to back, you know, doing radio. And I'd heard about him and Ian coming to California to skate at Winchester Skateboard Park, the skateboard park I was just telling you about that was by my dad's. So it was crazy. I got to ask him, I'm like, hey, I've always heard about this story of you. He goes, oh, yeah. Ian's sister lived in Palo Alto, and we took the bus from D.C. to stay with her for a couple weeks in the summer.
Wow.
And we would come down and we would skate at Winchester because we had seen it in the magazines. And, you know, this is early 80s. And at this point, I don't know if they're in Minor Threat or I don't know if they're in, you know, I don't think Ian's in Minor Threat or Teen Idols has happened or any. Or
oh,
SOA.
Wow.
I don't think.
They're kids.
They're kids. Yeah. Like, I don't think SOA, I don't think any of that has happened because also the story, they told me they, while they were there, they went and saw the Circle Jerks at the MAB in San Francisco, because Palo Alto's right in between San Jose and San Francisco. And they went there and they saw, and that was the show in San Francisco where a bunch of LA punks came up to the city and slam danced and like Circle Pit and all that. And Ian and Henry are there and they take that back with them to DC.
Wow.
And start dancing
wow.
like that.
Yeah,
and
this is pre-internet.
This
probably weren't even that many zines at that point either.
No, like, and I remember talking to Henry, and he goes, "Yeah, you know, he told me the whole story," and I was like, "Wow, man!" I go, "I'd always heard about that." And he goes, "Oh yeah, yeah, we came out to skate, and we came down to Winchester every day," and I was like, "Really?" You know, and it's funny because if they were there in the summer, you know, there's a strong possibility that, you know, because I spent every summer until the park closed just skateboarding. That was it. Skateboarding and listening to music. And it really changed everything for me because up until that moment, like I said, I wasn't really good at a lot of sports. And it really gave me an identity. Like, I really enjoyed, like, skateboarding to me was everything. And it also, I was in the right place at the right time because Steve Caballero was our, you know, he's my friend. And he was there. He's from San Jose. So I got to watch his whole career from when he was an amateur all the way through the Bones Brigade, all the way through. I was there when Stacy Peralta, you know, came to meet with him and sign him, and, you know, and
oh,
he
wow.
was a writer for Pal. And so it was so amazing to be on the sidelines of watching this athlete that was just, you know, at the time you're just like, you know, he was so beyond anyone else at the skateboard park, but you just thought, yeah, it's Stevie. It's, you know, it's our bro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just rips. But, That was also amazing. It was just amazing time in skateboarding, and it was amazing time in music too. And then it was just for me. I mean, after that, dude, it was like from 19, I would say from probably, you know, when I started skating at the park, I want to say like 81, that was just, you know, for the rest of my life, it was just music and skateboarding. That was really, I mean, that led me on the path for the next like 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing, man. Cause like, you know, like I grew up in Pennsylvania where it's mm-hmm. like, we didn't really have anything like that. So it's like when you skateboarded, Like, you would get made fun of for it, and you just kind of had to hang out in a parking lot as long as you could until they inevitably kicked you out, which happened every single time. And then we would go home discouraged and listen to, like, bands like Big Wig and listen to, like, some of the Revelation Records stuff at the time. Yeah. And Youth of Today.
Yeah.
And then we would just watch the Land Speed videos on VHS and think, well, we're not alone, but we're 3,000 miles away from anything.
And it's funny because in the I think in Dogtown Z Boys, the documentary, or at a certain, Henry Rollins, you know, he and Ian talk about that. They would look at magazines and be like, okay, what's going on? Like, somebody's doing something out there, you know,
because
at that point it was Skateboarder and Thrasher, you know, all of the bands you're talking about, you know, obviously, you know, they came later. So, so for me, you know, what ended up happening also was right around this time period, 82, 83, 84, I was in this, you know, I was just in the right place at the right time when punk rock hit the suburbs. And because I lived in San Jose, we were 40 miles away from San Francisco, and everyone came through. Everyone played. In the beginning, it was a club, the On Broadway and the MAB. They were right next to each other, and that's that. You know, I saw Social Distortion there for the first time. I saw, you know, Black Flag there, Circle Jerks. All of these bands I would see at this venue, and because everyone came to San Francisco, so everyone was coming up from LA to play these shows. And I was just, you know, lucky that I was able to go up to San Francisco and see these shows. And all these shows, you know, I was seeing. I remember when Minor Threat came through. You know, they did two shows at the On Broadway. You know, and I saw them. You know, I want to say, I mean, the show for Minor Threat was insane. It was Youth Brigade from Los Angeles, or 7 Seconds is a three piece. Yeah, 7 Seconds is a three piece. So it was,
how was it
Troy, Steve, and Kevin playing guitar. So I didn't know
Kevin played guitar.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
All right.
And that would happen every once in a while when they didn't have a guitar player. Kevin would play guitar, Steve would play bass. And
I guess he did do solo stuff. Yeah,
all right. Yeah, he plays acoustic.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, so he's totally way capable of playing guitar and ripping. And so I saw that night it was 7 Seconds as a three piece, and Youth Brigade and Minor Threat. And the opening band was this band called America's Hardcore that was awesome. And that was just, I was in the, like I said, right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then GBH, their first tour of America, I was there for that. Exploited, first time they ever came to America. You know, SSD Control, Kraut from New York City. I was really into Scream from DC, you know. I literally saw Scream and Pete Stahl and Franz Stahl, like literally, you know, unloading a station wagon that I want to say their dad like was driving. Like they were these little kids that like, and I was like,
wow,
dude, Scream. And I bought that record. You know, that was the first record that Discord put out that wasn't Minor Threat. That was the first band that they put out. So I was fully into Scream. 7 Seconds, you know, I saw, I got to see them, you know, so many different times. You know, some of the shows that just stand out that I still can't, you know, Peter and Test Tube Babies, first time they came to America, English Dogs, first time they came to America, and then all the LA bands, Circle Jerks, numerous times, and then when Adolescent, and then what ended up happening was, so then all of those bands, you know, came through, and then when those clubs went away, this new place, you know, I'm talking about, you know, maybe 3 years later, this place called The Farm opened up. And that was where bands like The Next Generation were coming through and playing. And that'd be like, you know, Operation Ivy, you know, or lots of shows with Operation Ivy, Verbal Abuse, a lot of the Bay Area, you know, bands from like Tales of Terror from San Francisco or Sacramento.
You get to see Op Ivy live?
I saw Op Ivy. That's how I met Tim mm-hmm. when he was in Op Ivy, because he used to work. I got into my first band around 85. I was in this band called Frontline. I was the singer, and we did shows with Op Ivy. They used to have this Day on the Farm thing where they'd have like 30 bands play. And we played. But I met Tim, the first time I met Tim was when he worked at Blondie's Pizza in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue. Pretty sure he worked there, and someone introduced us, and I, you know, just, you know, at that point he wasn't, you know, Tim from Rancid. He was just, I think at that point he's still Lint, you know. And he, you know, we just became friends. And then, you know, years later, when he moved to, when he came down to LA and did Rants and everything, we already knew each other. And I went to high school with Lars. Lars was like a few years younger. He was like a freshman when I was a senior. And we've been friends. We grew up in Campbell together. So I knew his older brother really well. And I knew Lars. Lars used to, you know, come to parties that we'd have when he was like a freshman.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've known him since he was a little kid.
So, we'll skip ahead a little bit. So when you started putting out music and, mm-hmm. and you started Side One Dummy, what was kind of that dynamic like going forward? Because it's like you had Epitaph right here
Well.
So you had like all these peers doing amazing things and you're doing things too. Like, so what was some of that dynamic?
We weren't doing anything at that point. It was just Bill and I, my partner and I have been partners for 23 years right now. Yeah. I think it's our 23rd year as a company. Yeah. Oh yeah. 23 years. And, at that point, I mean, we were nothing, you know, we couldn't get anyone to sign to the label. We'd put out some 7-inch. I mean, when we started Epitaph was so massive and they'd already been a label for a really long time by the time Smash happened. I mean, mm-hmm. they'd been around for a while. And I knew all the guys in Bad Religion, Jay Bentley, Graffin, and Hetson really well. They knew me since I was like a little teeny kid. You know, I was such a Bad Religion fanatic mm-hmm. growing up. Like, that was my band.
Yeah, but, I think Greg Graffin is like one of my favorite artists.
Yeah.
Just period.
Yeah.
Like just everything from like books to research yeah. to music.
Graffin is like, super smart, super intelligent, and he was always super kind to me. Jay Bentley was more of like the older brother that would, you know, let my band open for them and get me into a show and just really super supportive. I mean, I always joke around with Jay Bentley is he's been with me through my whole ride as an entertainer from when I was in my first punk band to when I was in Wax to when I was in 22 Jacks to when I got on the radio. He was the first guy that I interviewed to when I started doing stand up. He came to all my shows. Like, he's been on the ride the whole entire time and just such a great friend. So, but Brett, I didn't really know, because Brett was kind of more mysterious and more kind of, you know, he was Brett Gurewitz.
Well, at that point, was he like kind of a gatekeeper?
He was never, you know, okay. I know Brett, but I'm not tight with Brett.
Okay.
And that's not because, you know, like if Brett walked out and saw us sitting here in the Prius, he'd be like, hey, what's up? But he was Brett Gurewitz and it was like, he wasn't a gatekeeper. He never had like a standoffish vibe or anything. But I think I was more of like, wow, you know, what he had done with Epitaph and for me was, and then on top of being in Bad Religion, it was a double like, wow, man, this guy's, you know, I was probably just more like a little uneasy with like talking to him because he was, you know, he had done so many different things. And that for me was like, wow, like this guy's doing it. And I was such a nerd of the business. You know, I loved what Epitaph was doing. You know, I was a huge fan of Fat Records, all that stuff. I didn't want our label to be like their label though. And that was the hardest thing, because when we started our label, no one wanted to sign our label because Bill wasn't in Bad Religion. So we couldn't say, hey, go on tour with us. Mm-hmm. That was the card that Bad Religion would play when you signed to the label. You know, if you signed to Epitaph in those early years, there was a strong possibility you were going to go open for Bad Religion. So right. Imagine, you know, Joe Sib and Bill Armstrong show up. Hey man, want to be on Side One? Okay, what can you do? I don't know. We're just two dudes that really love music and drink a lot of coffee, and we'll work super hard for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, Brett comes along. Hey, you want to go to Europe with Bad Religion? You know, you're gonna do that. So we knew coming out of the gate that we had to definitely be. We had to figure out how people would sign to the label, and it took like 5 years to finally, you know, figure out what our footing was in the scene, what we were going to be, who we were going to be. And what it ended up being was we weren't going to be like any of those labels. We never set out to be the label that we were, but what ended up happening is because we just signed what we loved. We signed bands that inspired us and that connected with people. And what ended up happening was we didn't have one of the same, we didn't have five or 10 of the same thing. We had, you know, all our bands were totally different. You know, you had Flogging Molly, and they were you know, this Celtic Irish punk rock thing before that had happened, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, Dropkick Murphys was around, but Dropkick Murphys, you know, Flogging Molly was around, you know, and inspired those guys. With that said, you know, so, and we didn't go and sign like 20 Flogging Mollies after that, you know. Mm-hmm. Then we went, hey, let's sign, you know, let's do Gogo Bordello. That was totally, you know, you have these immigrants from all over the world, you know, that no one had done anything like that. And then, you know, you have a band like Gaslight Anthem, Royal Crown Review, you know, and then all the bands in between, you know, the bands like, you know, whether it was, you know, putting out, you know, two or three records from 7 Seconds, you know, bands like, you know, rockabilly bands, Custom Made Scared, or kind of psychobilly, rockabilly, I don't know what you call them, but like Custom Made Scared, you know, just different sounding bands, the Briggs from L, you know, there was just, we never had a sound, and that I think was what really made Side One different than the rest of the label.
So would you say, like,
does that
maybe,
make sense?
No, it does. I mean, would you say maybe you went more eclectic quicker?
We went way more eclectic, but I would love to tell you, Ron, that it was planned. It wasn't.
Okay.
Like, none of it was planned.
None of the great things in
yeah.
life are.
No, and but can I tell you, the whole time we were doing it, we didn't know what we were doing.
Okay.
We were like, oh God, man, we got to be like fat. We tried to sign those bands.
Okay.
We wanted to have a sound. We were like, we got to have a sound. And we tried, but it just wouldn't work out. And then what ended up happening is the first band, you know, we were around for, I want to say 5 years. I'm not really sure when that first Flogging Molly Swagger came out, but up until that point, we were doing okay. We signed a lot of bands that were already kind of maybe past their heyday. You know, we did a record with Suicidal Tendencies, which was great. We did a record with Royal Crown Review. We had kind of learned that when you work with those big bands and then they kind of have to come back down to working with a smaller label again, there is a little bit of, you know, it's hard. They've already done all their first time experiences with other people, so they're not super psyched when you're like, hey, you're gonna go on tour. They're like, I kind of already did that, or hey, we're gonna, you know, they've already kind of done it. So for
us, like, well, we could do this ourselves because we have this following.
Yeah, you know, or it wasn't so much they could do it themselves, but there's a little bit less excitement, you know.
Okay.
And then what ended up happening was, we realized that signing, you know, what we needed to do was sign young bands and have their, you know, the first time they're on Conan O'Brien or the first time they're on The Tonight Show or any, you know, doing any of these big things at that time that were exciting. Like that was a big thing to do Conan O'Brien. That was a big thing to do The Tonight Show then. It was great to have those first time experiences where it's a first for them and it's a first for us. So it's like everyone's excited and it, you know, you're kind of building it as you go, opposed to maybe it's already been built and you're kind of just maintaining it.
Yeah. Well, it's like one of those things, like, I feel like with the evolution of, like, the record label, it's like, and this is just coming from my perspective as a listener, it's like some labels that they did kind of have, like, a sound.
Totally.
It's like that's it. But then other labels, they still had a brand, but it was a little more like, we just trust this is going to be cool. Like something like 4AD,
mm-hmm.
you know, like when
great
I was
label.
Yeah,
great
like,
label,
like high school and college years, that they didn't have a specific sound.
Yeah.
But like, if I knew it was out on 4AD, I pretty much knew it was going to be cool. And I was likely to trust that brand and buy that record.
For me, it was the same with SSD or SST. Mm-hmm. SST puts something out, I'm going to get it. You know, Twin Tone puts something out, I'm going to get it. You know, Lookout, you know, for a long time there, Lookout Records put something out, you're going to get it. Cause mm-hmm. you knew, okay, this is what it's going to sound like. It might be a little weird cause it's Lookout, but I'm going to dig it. Epitaph went through that. Fat Records definitely went through that. And I think those things kind of develop. The ones that connect the most are the ones that develop naturally and that are truly a reflection of who the people are that are running that label. You know, when Brett, you know, had Epitaph and it was Rancid and Offspring and all these records blowing up, and Fat Mike had, you know, his whole sound. I mean, that's what he listens to. Fat Mike listens to that music. You know, he was never one of those guys that was just going to sign something because it would do well. And then, and we ended up being the same way. The only difference for us was we didn't sign two of the same band. That was our... And then once we figured that out, we stuck to that.
Okay.
Yeah, once we did figure it out at a certain point because we were like, we just want the best of that. Like, whatever that band is, like, when Gaslight Anthem was, you know, when we signed them and they were doing well, and then we just... I mean, at that moment, all of these bands started sounding like Gaslight Anthem, and we got so many demos and people, hey, you should check. And it was just like, no, it's cool. You know, those bands are cool, but we've got the best. We've got, you know, we've got Gaslight Anthem, and we've got Brian and Benny and, you know, those guys. And this is the best of that scene for us. We want just that. And then we would work super hard on it.
So do you think, like, that type of sort of, like, brand loyalty still exists the way it used to, or how has it evolved?
It's just changed now. You know, back then you stayed on a label for a really long time, and like when I was an artist, you know, and signing to a label, like there was the idea that you would do multiple records with a label. I don't want to say there isn't loyalty, because you know, that's a big conversation. But nowadays, you know, you'll do a record, you know, we'll do a record with a band and might be one or two records, and then they move on to another label. Or, you know, a band might do a record on one label and then say, yeah, we want to do a record on another label. I think now it's just, I don't think people hold on to that, at least. And, you know, you're also talking to me and kind of where I'm floating in the world of music is, I don't know, you know, and I'm sure there's some basement in the Midwest or maybe even here in California that's like, dude, we're on, you know, we're on like no noise records and we're a crew and we roll tight, you know, like maybe there's that scene going on. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm also a 50-year-old man, so I don't know if that exists. Like, when, you know, I don't, you know, like, you know what, sure, we were talking about, like, you know, Discord Records, you know, like when I was growing up and I read about Discord, it was like you thought all those dudes hung out on that front porch where that Minor Threat picture was taken all the time. You're like, oh my gosh, like, Flex Your Head, man, did all those bands play together all the time? You know, like, I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. And even with Epitaph, like, do they all hang together? You know, I'm sure though there's labels that maybe there is that still going on. I don't know in my world if that still exists. I know that, you know, how many labels has, you know, some of the bands on our label have been on. It's just, I think nowadays bands are like, hey, I want to do some records with you. I like the vibe of side one, and they do it. And then if, you know, if it works, cool. You say, let's do another one. And if it doesn't, you're like, cool, we did that one together.
Well, even from the standpoint of the listener, I mean, do you think, like, it's like, because that was the way, you know, I was really becoming into the scene pre-internet. Yeah. But I was just at the tail end of that. I mean, like,
When I started the label, I totally started it with, like, it's a side one dummy. You're on side one dummy. We roll together. This is a crew. This is a family. That was totally my, like, 100% dream for what I wanted the label to be. But what happens is everything. That flavor, I don't know, is as important to bands today.
Okay.
And that's just me making my, I don't think it's as important today what logo you have on the back of your record. Mm-hmm. You know, and we never made it about, like, you're on side one, so you're rad. It was more like, man, we're so stoked that you're on our label, because if you weren't, we're just a logo.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and we love what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's for us, it was always the band's rad and we're just stoked we're working together.
Mm-hmm.
That was totally it. Not like, yeah, you're lucky you're on side one. It was like, no, we're lucky you're working with us, because if you don't, we don't have bands to work with, and then no one works and everyone has to go get a real job. You know, that was our biggest fear, getting a real job. That's something I've avoided my entire life.
Me too, man.
You know, yeah
me too.
That's my biggest fear. It's, you know,
every day that's my job description.
That's why I get up and do every day work as hard as I can, because I don't want to get a real job. And I'm totally, you know, when I'm at Trader Joe's and I'm bagging my groceries, helping the dude, I always am like, yeah, like, I'm, you know, I'm, this could be a possibility if I don't keep working hard doing what I do, you know. Mm-hmm. Not that I'd be, you know, not that that's a lame gig, because, you know, like, you got to work, but I'm always like, I'm aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump to present then, man. How did comedy start creeping into your wheelhouse?
For me, it was real simple. Just being like, I was a singer in a band, you know, since I was 15 years old, I think. And so I'd been, you know, in a band from 15 to, I think 22 Jacks ended right around 32, so like your age. And right around that time period, I took off about from 32 to about, I want to say like 40. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to focus on Side One Dummy. I'm just going to sign bands. And that was really good because we had a really great, that was like, a lot of great stuff happened. but I'd always was trying to find a way back onto stage. And about 13 years ago, I got on the radio where I was hosting this radio show. And I would tell stories and people were like, it's super funny. And then that led to me toying with the idea of like, wow, I always wanted to do stand up. I wonder if I could. And then I wrote this one man show and I did that. And that was kind of more, it had a lot to do with music and punk rock and everything. And then what ended up happening was I ended up doing that for about 2 to 3 years. And then I made the decision, I want to do stand up. Like I want to really try to do that right now. And that was, you know, 7 years ago. So I was like 43. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, really? Why would you want to do that? And I was like, I don't know. I just want to try it. I want to see if I can do it. And I just it was the same experience I got when like I got into music. It was just like, you know, I got really into the writing aspect and like, you know, like you and I were talking before, like, you know, how do you make someone laugh in 5 minutes? What's the difference, you know, with this joke? Why does this work? Why does this not work? What kind of laugh do you want to get? What kind of laugh do you want to avoid getting? You know, all that stuff. And I just really, really nerded out on it. And then I really enjoyed just doing stand-up. And I was fortunate that being here in L.A., I got up at different clubs and the Laugh Factory and the Improv. And that kind of really opened up a lot of doors. And then, you know, it's kind of one thing led to another. You know, someone said, hey, you know, you should be on this show. Hey, you should come and do this. And hey, you should come and do that. And it's got, you know, it's been such baby steps for the last 7 years, which has been fine just because I never really expected anything from it. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to do stand-up because I love doing it. And I'm grateful that someone actually wants to invite me to do a show. Like I was just in like, you know, like this past weekend I was telling you I was doing shows here in San Diego and tonight I'm doing LA. And I'm just grateful that people are like, hey, you're funny, come and do this. Like I always say, getting invited to do stand up is like the best feeling because you're like, wow, like someone invited me to do a show. And as you know, as a stand up, it's so hard. It's such a grind.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and the thing about stand up is you can't get good at it or maintain being good at it unless you get up, you know, regularly. You know, and that's just the bottom line. Like it's not like anything else where you're like, oh, I can kind of do it here and there, and then you know, I'll be good on Friday. Like you have to be doing it all the time.
So where can people learn more about you?
Where can they learn more about me? I would just go to my Facebook page, you know, Joe Sib. Or it would just be Joe Sib, you know, there. And then I'm also like the other thing that like I started a year ago is this parenting podcast called Rad Parenting. So I'm really, that's kind of my main focus right now. It's like I do this parenting podcast with this host, Anaya Bogue. She's awesome. She wrote this book, 9 Ways We're Screwing Up Our Girls and How We Can Stop. And I really dug that. And then she worked with my daughter a little bit. I met her. Came up with this idea for this podcast, Rad Parenting, and it's been awesome because we just tackle all of these subjects each and every week that range from like this week we interviewed a dad who had a one night stand but then raised the daughter with the woman that he had, but you know, not being married to her, but just because it was a one night stand, he didn't, you know, just bail. He like, all right, let's make this work. So it's like a whole story about that. And then last week we did a story on swearing in front of your kids. We did one on what else? We had the author who wrote This Is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids. She came on the show. She was awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, we've done about 50 episodes, and I'm really, really into that right now.
That's
like
awesome.
That's like what I really do.
So that's Rad Parenting.
And Rad Parenting. And you can go to it's rad-parenting.com, and then you can look me up on Facebook.
Right on, man. You guys have been listening to Two Italian American Dudes Geeking Out About Punk Rock. That's the new name now.
I love it. In a Prius.
In a Prius. Thanks a lot for doing this, Joe.
No problem, dude. Thanks for having me.